That doesn't mean anything, though. Gendry has the same kind of hair, too. Lots of people have black hair. I'm named Bella, the girl told Gendry. For the battle, I bet I could ring your bell, too. You want to?
No,
he said gruffly.
I bet you do.
She ran a hand along his arm.
I don't cost nothing to Friends of Thoris and the Lightning Lord.
No, I said. Gendry rose abruptly and stalked away from the table out into the night. Bella turned to Arya.
Don't he like girls?
Arya shrugged. He's just stupid. He likes to polish helmets and beat on swords with hammers.
Oh.
Bella tugged her gown back over her shoulder and went to talk with Jack be Lucky. Before long, she was sitting in his lap, giggling and drinking wine from his cup. Greenbeard had two girls, one on each knee. Angai had vanished with his freckle-faced wench, and Lem was gone as well. Tom Sevenstring sat by the fire, singing The Maids That Bloom in Spring. Arya sipped at the cup of watered wine the red-haired woman had allowed her, listening. Across the square the dead men were rotting in their crow cages, but inside the peach everyone was jolly, except it seemed to her that some of them were laughing too hard, somehow. It would have been a good time to sneak away and steal a horse, but Arya couldn't see how that would help her. She could only ride as far as the city gates.
That captain would never let me pass, and if he did, Harwin would come after me, or that huntsman with his dogs.
She wished she had her map, so she could see how far Stony Sept was from Riverrun. By the time her cup was empty, Arya was yawning. Gendry hadn't come back. Tom Sevenstrings was singing, Two Hearts That Beat as One, and kissing a different girl at the end of every verse. In the corner, by the window, Lem and Harwin sat talking to red-haired Tansy in low voices.
"Spent the night in Jamie's cell," she heard the woman say. "Her and this other wench, the one who slew Renly, all three of them together. And come the morn, Lady Catelyn cut him loose for love."
She gave a throaty chuckle.
"It's not true," Arya thought. "She never would."
She felt sad and angry and lonely all at once. An old man sat down beside her.
"Well, aren't she a pretty little peach?"
His breath smelled near as foul as the dead men in their cages, and his little pig eyes were crawling up and down her.
"Does my sweet peach have a name?"
For half a heartbeat she forgot who she was supposed to be. She wasn't any peach, but she couldn't be Arya Stark either. Not here with some smelly drunk she did not know.
She's my sister.
Gendry put a heavy hand on the old man's shoulder and squeezed.
Leave her be.
The man turned, spoiling for a quarrel. But when he saw Gendry's size, he thought better of it.
Your sister, is she? What kind of brother are you? I'd never bring no sister of mine to the beach. That I wouldn't.
He got up from the bench and moved off, muttering, in search of a new friend.
"Why did you say that?"
Arya hopped to her feet. "You're not my brother."
"That's right," he said angrily. "I'm too bloody low-born to be kin to my lady eye."
Arya was taken back by the fury in his voice.
"That's not the way I meant it." "Yes, it is."
He sat down on the bench, cradling a cup of wine between his hands.
"Go away. I want to drink this wine in peace. Then maybe I'll go and find that black-haired girl and ring her bell for her." "But I said, go away, my lady."
Arya whirled and left him there. A stupid, bull-headed, bastard boy, that's all he is. He could ring all the bells he wanted. It was nothing to her. Their sleeping room was at the top of the stairs under the eaves. Maybe the peach had no lack of beds, but there was only one to spare for the likes of them. It was a big bed, though. It filled the whole room, just about, and the musty straw-stuffed mattress looked large enough for all of them. Just now, though, she had it to herself. Her real clothes were hanging from a peg on the wall, between Gendry's stuff and Lem's. Arya took off the linen and lace, pulled her tunic over her head, climbed up into the bed, and burrowed under the blankets.
Queen Cersei,
she whispered into the pillow. King Joffrey, Sir Ilion, Sir Meron, Dunson, Raff and Polliver, the Tickler, the Hound, and Sir Gregor the Mountain. She liked to mix up the order of the names sometimes. It helped her remember who they were and what they'd done. Maybe some of them are dead, she thought. Maybe they're in iron cages somewhere, and the crows are picking out their eyes. Sleep came as quick as she closed her eyes. She dreamed of wolves that night, stalking through a wet wood with the smell of rain and rot and blood thick in the air. Only they were good smells in the dream, and Arya knew she had nothing to fear. She was strong and swift and fierce, and her pack was all around her, her brothers and sisters. They ran down a frightened horse together, tore its throat out, and feasted. And when the moon broke through the clouds, she threw back her head and howled. But when the day came, she woke to the barking of dogs. Arya sat up, yawning. Gendry was stirring on her left, and Lem Lemoncloak snoring loudly to her right. But the baying outside all but drowned them out. There must be 50 dogs out there. She crawled from under the blankets and hopped over Lem, Tom, and Jackby Lucky to the window. When she opened the shutters wide, wind and wet and cold all came flooding in together. The day was grey and overcast. Down below in the square, the dogs were barking, running in circles, growling and howling. There was a pack of them, great black mastiffs and lean wolfhounds, and black-and-white sheepdogs, and kinds Arya did not know, shaggy, brindled beasts with long yellow teeth. Between the inn and the fountain, a dozen riders sat astride their horses, watching the townsmen open the fat man's cage and tug his arm until his swollen corpse spilled out onto the ground. The dogs were at him at once, tearing chunks of flesh off his bones. Arya heard one of the riders laugh.
"Here's a new castle, you bloody Lannister bastard," he said. "A little snug for the likes of you, but we'll squeeze in, never fret."
Beside him a prisoner sat sullen, with coils of hempen rope tight around his wrists. Some of the townsfolk were throwing dung at him, but he never flinched.
"You'll rot in them cages!" his captor was shouting. "The crows will be picking out their eyes while we're spending all that good Lannister gold of yours. And when them crows are done, we'll send what's left of ye to your bloody brother, though I doubt he'll know ye."
The noise had woken half the peach. Gendry squeezed into the window beside Arya, and Tom stepped up behind them, naked as his name day.
"What's all the bloody shouting?" Lem complained from bed. "A man's trying to get some bloody sleep."
"Where's Greenbeard?" Tom asked him.
"Abed with Tansy," Lem said. "Why?"
"Best find him. Archer, too. The mad huntsman's come back, with another man for the cages."
"Lannister," said Arya. "I heard him say Lannister."
"Have they caught the Kingslayer?" Gendry wanted to know.
Down in the square, a thrown stone caught the captive on the cheek, turning his head. Not the Kingslayer, Arya thought, when she saw his face. The gods had heard her prayers, after all. John. Ghost was gone when the wildlings led their horses from the cave. Did he understand about Castle Black? John took a breath of the crisp morning air and allowed himself to hope. The eastern sky was pink near the horizon and pale grey higher up. The sword of the morning still hung in the south, the bright white star in its hilt blazing like a diamond in the dawn, but the blacks and greys of the darkling forest were turning once again to greens and golds, reds and russets. And above, the soldier pines and oaks and ash and sentinels stood the wall, the ice pale and glimmering beneath the dust and dirt that pocked its surface. The Magnar sent a dozen men riding west and a dozen more east to climb the highest hills they could find and watch for any sign of rangers in the wood or riders on the high ice. The Thens carried bronze-banded warhorns to give warning, should the watch be sighted. The other wildlings fell in, behind Jarl, John, and Ygritte, with the rest. This was to be the young raider's hour of glory. The wall was often said to stand 700 feet high, but Jarl had found a place where it was both higher and lower. Before them the ice rose sheer from out of the trees like some immense cliff, crowned by wind-carved battlements that loomed at least 800 feet high, perhaps 900 in spots. But that was deceptive, John realized, as they drew closer. Brandon the Builder had laid his huge foundation blocks along the heights whenever feasible, and hereabouts the hills rose wild and rugged. He'd once heard his uncle Benjamin say that the wall was a sword east of Castle Black, but a snake to the west. It was true. Sweeping in over one huge humped hill, the ice dipped down into a valley, climbed the knife edge of a long granite ridgeline for a league or more, ran along a jagged crest, dipped again into a valley deeper still, and then rose higher and higher, leaping from hill to hill as far as the eye could see into the mountainous west. Jarl had chosen to assault the stretch of ice along the ridge. Here, though the top of the wall loomed 800 feet above the forest floor, a good third of that height was earth and stone, rather than ice. The slope was too steep for their horses, almost as difficult to scramble as the fist of the first man, but still vastly easier to ascend than the sheer vertical face of the wall itself. And the ridge was densely wooded as well, offering easy concealment. Once, brothers in black had gone out every day with axes to cut back the encroaching trees, but those days were long past, and here the forest grew right up to the ice. The day promised to be damp and cold, and damper and colder by the wall, beneath those tons of ice. The closer they got, the more the Thens held back. They have never seen the wall before, not even the Magna, John realized. It frightens them. In the Seven Kingdoms it was said that the wall marked the end of the world. That is true for them as well. It was all in where you stood. And where do I stand? John did not know. To stay with Ygritte, he would need to become a wildling, heart and soul. If he abandoned her, to return to his duty, the Magna might cut her heart out. And if he took her with him, assuming she would go, which was far from certain, well, he could scarcely bring her back to Castle Black to live among the brothers. A deserter and a wildling could expect no welcome anywhere in the Seven Kingdoms. We could go look for Gendel's children, I suppose, though they'd be more like to eat us than to take us in. The wall did not awe Jarl's raiders, John saw. They have done this before, every man of them. Jarl called out names when they dismounted, beneath the ridge, and 11 gathered round him. All were young. The oldest could not have been more than 25, and 2 of the 10 were younger than John. Everyone was lean and hard, though. They had a look of sinewy strength that reminded him of Stone Snake, the brother the Half-Hand had sent off afoot when Rattleshirt was hunting them. In the very shadow of the wall the wildlings made ready, winding thick coils of hempen rope around one shoulder and down across their chests, and lacing on queer boots of supple doeskin. The boots had spikes jutting from the toes, iron for Jarl and 2 others, bronze for some, but most often jagged bone. Small stone-headed hammers hung from one hip, a leathern bag of stakes from the other. Their ice axes were antlers with sharpened tines, bound to wooden hafts with strips of hide. The 11 climbers sorted themselves into 3 teams of 4. Jarl himself made the 12th man. "Mance promises swords for every man of the first team to reach the top," he told them, his breath misting in the cold air. "Southern swords of castle forged steel, and your name in the song he'll make of this, that too. What more could a free man ask? Up, and the others take the hindmost!" The others take them all, thought John, as he watched them scramble up the steep slope of the ridge and vanish beneath the trees. It would not be the first time the wildlings had scaled the wall. not even the 101st. The patrols stumbled on climbers 2 or 3 times a year, and rangers sometimes came on the broken corpses of those who had fallen. Along the east coast, the raiders most often built boats to slip across the Bay of Seals. In the west, they would descend into the black depths of the gorge to make their way around the Shadow Tower, but in between, the only way to defeat the wall was to go over it, and many a raider had. Fewer come back, though, he thought, with a certain grim pride. Climbers must, of necessity, leave their mounts behind, and many younger, greener raiders began by taking the first horses they found. Then a hue and cry would go up, ravens would fly, and as often as not, the night's watch would hunt them down and hang them before they could get back with their plunder and stolen women. Jarl would not make that mistake, John knew. But he wondered about Stir. The Magnor is a ruler, not a raider. He may not know how the game is played.
There they are,
Ygritte said, and John glanced up to see the first climber emerge above the treetops. It was Jarl. He had found a sentinel tree that leaned against the wall, and led his men up the trunk to get a quicker start. The wood should never have been allowed to creep so close. They're 300 feet up, and they haven't touched the ice itself yet. He watched the wildling move carefully from wood to wall, hacking out a handhold with short, sharp blows of his ice axe, then swinging over. The rope around his waist tied him to the second man in line, still edging up the tree. Step by slow step, Jarl moved higher, kicking out toe holes with his spiked boots when there were no natural ones to be found. When he was 10 feet above the sentinel, he stopped upon a narrow, icy ledge, slung his axe from his belt, took out his hammer, and drove an iron stake into a cleft. The second man moved onto the wall behind him, while the third was scrambling to the top of the tree. The other two teams had no happily placed trees to give them a leg up, and before long the Thens were wondering whether they had gotten lost climbing the ridge. Jarl's party were all on the wall and 80 feet up before the leading climbers from the other groups came into view. The teams were spaced a good 20 yards apart. Jarl's four were in the center. To the right of them was a team led by Grig the Goat, whose long blonde braid made him easy to spot from below. To the left, a very thin man named Eric led the climbers.
"So slow," the Magnar complained loudly, as he watched them edge their way upward. "Has he forgotten the cruise? He should climb faster, afore we are discovered."
John had to hold his tongue. He remembered the Skirling Pass all too well, and the moonlight climb he'd made with Stone Snake. He had swallowed his heart 6 times that night, and by the end his arms and legs had been aching and his fingers were half frozen. And that was stone, not ice. Stone was solid. Ice was treacherous stuff at the best of times, and on a day like this, when the wall was weeping, the warmth of a climber's hand might be enough to melt it. The huge blocks could be frozen rock hard inside, but their outer surface would be slick, with runnels of water trickling down, and patches of rotten ice where the air had gotten in. Whatever else the wildlings are, they're brave. All the same, John found himself hoping that Stir's fears proved well-founded. If the gods are good, a patrol would chance by and put an end to this. "No wall can keep you safe," his father told him once, as they walked the walls of Winterfell. "A wall is only as strong as the men who defend it. The wildlings might have 120 men, but 4 defenders would be enough to see them off, with a few well-placed arrows and perhaps a pail of stones." No defenders appeared, however. Not 4, not even 1. The sun climbed the sky, and the wildlings climbed the wall. Jarl's 4 remained well ahead till noon, when they hit a patch of bad ice. Jarl had looped his rope around a wind-carved pinnace, and was using it to support his weight, when the whole jagged thing suddenly crumbled and came crashing down, and him with it. Chunks of ice as big as a man's head bombarded the 3 below, but they clung to the handholds, and the stakes held, and Jarl jerked to a sudden halt at the end of the rope. By the time his team had recovered from that mischance, Grig the Goat had almost drawn even with them. Eric's paw remained well behind. The face where they were climbing looked smooth and unpitted, covered with a sheet of ice melt that glistened wetly where the sun brushed it. Grieg's section was darker to the eye, with more obvious features. Long horizontal ledges where a block had been imperfectly positioned atop the block below, cracks and crevices, even chimneys along the vertical joins, where wind and water had eaten holes large enough for a man to hide in. Giles soon had his men edging upward again. His four and Griggs moved almost side by side, with Eric's 50 feet below. Deerhorn axes chopped and hacked, sending showers of glittery shards cascading down onto the trees. Stone hammers pounded stakes deep into the ice to serve as anchors for the ropes. The iron stakes ran out before they were halfway up, and after that the climbers used horn and sharpened bone. And the men kicked, driving the spikes on their boots against the hard, unyielding ice again and again and again and again to make one foothold. Their legs must be numb, John thought, by the fourth hour. How long can they keep on with that? He watched as restless as the Magna, listening for the distant moan of a thin war horn. But the horn stayed silent, and there was no sign of the night's watch. By the sixth hour, Jarl had moved ahead of Grig the goat again, and his men were widening the gap.
"The manse's pet must want a sword," the Magna said, shading his eyes.
The sun was high in the sky, and the upper third of the wall was a crystalline blue from below, reflecting so brilliantly that it hurt the eyes to look on it. Giles Four and Griggs were all but lost in the glare, though Eric's team was still in shadow. Instead of moving upward, they were edging their way sideways at about 500 feet, making for a chimney. John was watching them inch along when he heard the sound, a sudden crack that seemed to roll along the ice, followed by a shout of alarm, and then the air was full of shards and shrieks and falling men, as a sheet of ice, a foot thick and 50 feet square, broke off from the wall and came tumbling, crumbling, rumbling, sweeping all before it. Even down at the foot of the ridge some chunks came spinning through the trees and rolling down the slope. John grabbed Ygritte and pulled her down to shield her, and one of the thens was struck in the face by a chunk that broke his nose. And when they looked up, Jarl and his team were gone. Men, ropes, stakes, all gone. Nothing remained above 600 feet. There was a wound in the wall where the climbers had clung half a heartbeat before. The ice within as smooth and white as polished marble and shining in the sun. Far, far below, there was a faint red smear where someone had smashed against a frozen pinnace. "The wall defends itself," John thought, as he pulled Ygritte back to her feet. They found Jarl in a tree, impaled upon a splintered branch, and still roped to the three men who lay broken beneath him. One was still alive, but his legs and spine were shattered, and most of his ribs as well.
"Mercy!" he said when they came upon him.
One of the thens smashed his head in with a big stone mace. The Magna gave orders, and his men began to gather fuel for a pyre. The dead were burning when Grig the Goat reached the top of the wall. By the time Eric's four had joined them, nothing remained of Jarl and his team but bone and ash. The sun had begun to sink by then, so the climbers wasted little time. They unwound the long coils of hemp they had looped around their chests, tied them all together, and tossed down one end. The thought of trying to climb 500 feet up that rope filled John with dread, but Mance had planned better than that. The raiders Jarl had left below uncast a huge ladder with rungs of woven hemp as thick as a man's arm and tied it to the climber's rope. Eric and Grig and their men grunted and heaved, pulled it up, staked it to the top, then lowered the rope again and hauled up a second ladder. There were five altogether. When all of them were in place, the Magnor shouted a brusque command in the old tongue, and five of his thens started up together. Even with the ladders, it was no easy climb. Ygritte watched them struggle for a while. "I hate this wall," she said in a low, angry voice. "Can you feel how
cold it is.
It's made of ice, John pointed out.
You know nothing, John Snow. This wall is made of blood.
Nor had it drunk its fill. By sunset, two of the Thanes had fallen from the ladder to their deaths, but they were the last. It was near midnight before John reached the top. The stars were out again, and Ygritte was trembling from the climb.
"I almost fell," she said with tears in her eyes. "Twice, thrice. The wall was trying to shake me off. I could feel it."
One of the tears broke free and trickled down her cheek. "The worst is behind us," John tried to sound confident. "Don't be frightened." He tried to put an arm around her. Ygritte slammed the heel of her hand into his chest, so hard it stung even through his layers of wool, mail, and boiled leather.
"I wasn't frightened. You know nothing, John Snow."
"Why are you crying, then?"
"Not for fear."
She kicked savagely at the ice beneath her with a heel, chopping out a chunk.
"I'm crying because we never found the Horn of Winter. We opened 50 graves and let all those shades loose in the world, and never found the Horn of Joriman to bring this cold thing down."
Jamie. His hand burned. Still long after they had snuffed out the torch they'd used to sear his bloody stump. Days after, he could still feel the fire lancing up his arm, and his fingers twisting in the flames, the fingers he no longer had. He had taken wounds before, but never like this. He had never known there could be such pain. Sometimes, unbidden, old prayers bubbled from his lips, prayers he learned as a child and never thought of since, prayers he had first prayed with Cersei kneeling beside him in the sept at Castle Rock. Sometimes he even wept until he heard the mummers laughing. Then he made his eyes go dry and his heart go dead, and prayed for his fever to burn away his tears.
"Now I know how Tyrion has felt all those times they laughed at him."
After the second time he fell from the saddle, they bound him tight to Brienne of Tarth and made them share a horse again. One day, instead of back to front, they bound them face to face.
"Ah, the lovers!" Shagwell sighed loudly. "Ah, what a lovely sight they are. 'Twould be cruel to separate the good knight and his lady." Then he laughed, that shrill high laugh of his, and said, "Ah, but which one is the knight and which one is the lady?"
"If I had my hand, you'd learn that soon enough," Jamie thought. His arms ached and his legs were numb from the ropes, but after a while none of that mattered. His world shrunk to the throb of agony that was his phantom hand, and Brienne pressed against him. "She's warm, at least," he consoled himself, though the wench's breath was as foul as his own. His hand was always between them. Erswick had hung it about his neck on a cord, so it dangled down against his chest, slapping Brienne's breasts as Jamie slipped in and out of consciousness. His right eye was swollen shut, the wound inflamed, where Brienne had cut him during their fight, but it was his hand that hurt the most. Blood and pus seeped from the stump, and the missing hand throbbed every time the horse took a step. His throat was so raw he could not eat, but he drank wine when they gave it him, and water when that was all they offered. Once they handed him a cup, and he quaffed it straight away, trembling, and the brave companions burst into laughter so loud and harsh it hurt his ears.
"That's horse piss you're drinking, Kingslayer,"
Rorg told him. Jamie was so thirsty he drank it anyway, but afterward he retched it all back up. They made Brienne wash the vomit out of his beard, just as they had made her clean him up when he soiled himself in the saddle. One damp cold morning, when he was feeling slightly stronger, a madness took hold of him, and he reached for the Dornishman's sword with his left hand and wrenched it clumsily from its scabbard. "Let them kill me," he thought, "so long as I die fighting, a blade in hand." But it was no good. Shagwell came hopping from leg to leg, dancing nimbly aside when Jamie slashed at him. Unbalanced, he staggered forward, hacking wildly at the fool, but Shagwell spun and ducked and darted until all the mummers were laughing at Jamie's futile efforts to land a blow. When he tripped over a rock and stumbled to his knees, the fool leapt in and planted a wet kiss atop his head. Rourke finally flung him aside and kicked the sword from Jamie's feeble fingers as he tried to bring it up.
"That was amusing, Kingslayer," said Vargo Holt. "But if you try it again, I should take your other hand, or perhaps a foot."
Jamie lay on his back afterwards, staring at the night sky, trying not to feel the pain that snaked up his right arm every time he moved it. The night was strangely beautiful. The moon was a graceful crescent, and it seemed as though he had never seen so many stars. The king's crown was at the zenith, and he could see the stallion rearing, and there the swan. The moon maid, shy as ever, was half hidden behind a pine tree. "How can such a night be beautiful?" he asked himself. "Why would the stars want to look down on such as me?"
"Jamie," Brian whispered, so faintly he thought he was dreaming it. "Jamie, what are you doing?"
"Dying," he whispered back.
"No," she said. "No, you must live."
He wanted to laugh. "Stop telling me what to do, wench. I'll die if it pleases me."
"Are you so craven?"
The word shocked him. He was Jamie Lannister, a knight of the King's Guard. He was the Kingslayer. No man had ever called him craven. Other things they called him. Yes, oathbreaker, liar, murderer. They said he was cruel, treacherous, reckless, but never craven. "What else can I do but die?"
"Live," she said. "Live and fight and take revenge."
But she spoke too loudly. Rorg heard her voice, if not her words, and came over to kick her, shouting at her to hold her bloody tongue if she wanted to keep it.
"Craven," Jamie thought, as Brian fought to stifle her moans.
"Can it be? They took my sword hand. Was that all I was, a sword hand? Gods be good, is it true?"
The wench had the right of it. He could not die. Cersei was waiting for him. She would have need of him. And Tyrion, his little brother, who loved him for a lie. And his enemies were waiting too, the young wolf who had beaten him in the Whispering Wood and killed his men around him. Edmure Tully, who had kept him in darkness and chains, these brave companions. When morning came, he made himself eat. They fed him a mush of oats, horse food, but he forced down every spoon. He ate again at evenfall and the next day.
"Live," he told himself harshly, when the mush was like to gag him. "Live for Cersei, live for Tyrion, live for vengeance. A Lannister always pays his debts."
His missing hand throbbed and burned and stank.
"When I reach King's Landing, I'll have a new hand forged, a golden hand, and one day I'll use it to rip out Vargo Holt's throat."
The days and the nights blurred together in a haze of pain. He would sleep in the saddle, pressed against Brian, his nose full of the stink of his rotting hand, and then at night he would lie awake on the hard ground, caught in a waking nightmare. Weak as he was, they always bound him to a tree. It gave him some cold consolation to know that they feared him that much, even now. Brian was always bound beside him. She lay there in her bonds like a big dead cow, saying not a word.
"The wench has built a fortress inside herself. They will rape her soon enough, but behind her walls they cannot touch her."
But Jamie's walls were gone. They had taken his hand. They had taken his sword hand, and without it, he was nothing. The other was no good to him. Since the time he could walk, his left arm had been his shield arm no more. It was his right hand that made him a knight, his right arm that made him a man. One day he heard Urswick say something about Harrenhal and remembered that was to be their destination. That made him laugh aloud, and that made Timian slash his face with a long, thin whip. The cut bled, but beside his hand he scarcely felt it.
"Why did you laugh?" the wench asked him that night in a whisper. "Harrenhal was where they gave me the white cloak," he whispered back. "Whence great Tawny.
He wanted to show us all his big castle and his fine sons. I wanted to show them, too. I was only 15, but no one could have beat me that day. Ares never let me joust. He laughed again. He sent me away. But now I'm coming back. They heard the laugh. That night it was Jamie who got the kicks and punches. He hardly felt them either, until Rorg slammed a boot into his stump, and then he fainted. It was the next night when they finally came. Three of the worst. Shagwell, Noseless Rorg, and Fat Dothraki Zolo, the one who'd cut his hand off. Zolo and Rorg were arguing about who would go first as they approached. There seemed to be no question but that the fool would be going last. Shagwell suggested they should both go first and take her front and rear. Zolo and Rorg liked that notion. Only then they began to fight about who would get the front and who the rear. They will leave her a cripple, too, but inside, where it does not show. "Wench," he whispered, as Zolo and Rorg were cursing one another, "let them have the meat, and you go far away. It will be over quicker, and they will get less pleasure from it."
"They will get no pleasure from what I'll give them," she whispered back, defiant.
"Stupid, stubborn, brave bitch. She was going to get herself good and killed, he knew it. And what do I care if she does? If she hadn't been so pig-headed, I still have a hand." Yet he heard himself whisper, "Let them do it, and go away inside." That was what he'd done when the Starks had died before him, Lord Rickard cooking in his armour while his son Brandon strangled himself trying to save him. Think of Renly, if you loved him. Think of Tarth, mountains and seas, pools, waterfalls, whatever you have on your Sapphire Isle. Think. But Rorg had won the argument by then.
"You're the ugliest woman I ever seen," he told Brian. "But don't think I can't make you uglier. You want a nose like mine? Find me, and you'll get one. And two eyes, that's too many. One scream out of you, and I'll pop one out and make you eat it. And then I'll pull your fucking teeth out, one by one."
"Oh, do it, Rorg," pleaded Shagwell. "Without her teeth, she'll look just like my dear old mother." He cackled. "And I always wanted to fuck my dear old mother up the ass."
Jamie chuckled. "There's a funny fool. I have a riddle for you, Shagwell. Why do you care if she screams?"
"Oh, wait. I know,"
he shouted. "Sapphires?" As loudly as he could. Cursing, Rorg kicked at his stump again. Jamie howled. "I never knew there was such agony in the world," was the last thing he remembered thinking. It was hard to say how long he was gone, but when the pain spit him out, Urswick was there, and Vargo Hote himself.
"'Feet not to be touched!" the goat screamed, spraying spittle all over Zala. "'Feet has to be a maid, you fools! She's worth a bagful of sapphires!"
And from then on, every night, Hote put guards on them to protect them from his own. Two nights passed in silence before the wench found the courage to whisper.
"Jamie, why did you shout out?"
"Why did I shout sapphires, you mean? Use your wits, wench. Would this lot have cared if I'd shouted rape?"
"You did not need to shout at all. You're hard enough to look at with a nose. Besides, I wanted to make the ghost say sapphires."
He chuckled. "A good thing for you, I'm such a liar. An honourable man would have told the truth about the Sapphire Isle."
"All the same," she said, "I thank you, sir."
His hand was throbbing again. He ground his teeth and said, "A Lannister pays his debts. That was for the river and those rocks you dropped on Robin Rhaegar." The goat wanted to make a show of parading him in, so Jamie was made to dismount a mile from the gates of Harrenhal. A rope was looped around his waist, a second around Brian's wrists. The ends were tied to the pommel of Vargo Hote's saddle. They stumbled along, side by side, behind the Kohorik's striped zorse. Jamie's rage kept him walking. The linen that covered the stump was grey and stinking with pus. His phantom fingers screamed with every step.
"I am stronger than they know," he told himself. "I am still a Lannister. I am still a knight of the King's Guard."
He would reach Harrenhal, and then King's Landing. He would live,
and I will pay this debt with interest.
As they approached the cliff-like walls of Black Harren's monstrous castle, Brienne squeezed his arm.
"Lord Bolton holds his castle. The Boltons are bannermen to the Starks." "The Boltons skin their enemies."
Jamie remembered that much about the Northmen. Tyrion would have known all there was to know about the Lord of the Dreadfort, but Tyrion was 1,000 leagues away with Cersei.
"I cannot die while Cersei lives," he told himself. "We will die together, as we were born together."
The Castleton outside the walls had been burned to ash and blackened stone, and many men and horses had recently encamped beside the lake shore, where Lord Went had staged his great tourney in the year of the false spring. A bitter smile touched Jamie's lips as they crossed that torn ground. Someone had dug a privy trench in the very spot where he'd once knelt before the king to say his vows.
"I never dreamed how quick the sweet would turn to sour. Ares would not even let me savour that one night. He honoured me, and then he spat on me." "The banners," Brian observed. "Flayed man and Twin Tire, see? King Rob's sworn men, there, above the gatehouse, grey and white. They fly the direwolf."
Jamie twisted his head upward for a look. "That's your bloody wolf, true enough," he grunted her. "And those are heads to either side of it." Soldiers, servants, and camp followers gathered to hoot at them. A spotted bitch followed them through the camps, barking and growling, until one of the Lyseni impaled her on a lance and galloped to the front of the column.
"I am bearing Kingslayer's banner," he shouted, shaking the dead dog above Jamie's head.
The walls of Harrenhal were so thick that passing beneath them was like passing through a stone tunnel. Vargo Hoat had sent two of his Dothraki ahead to inform Lord Bolton of their coming, so the outer ward was full of the curious. They gave way as Jamie staggered past, the rope around his waist, jerking and pulling at him whenever he slowed.
"I'll give you the Kingslayer,"
Vargo Hoat proclaimed in that thick, slubbery voice of his. A spear jabbed at the small of Jamie's back, sending him sprawling. Instinct made him put out his hands to stop his fall. When his stump smashed against the ground, the pain was blinding. Yet somehow he managed to fight his way back to one knee. Before him, a flight of broad stone steps led up to the entrance of one of Harrenhal's colossal round towers. Five knights and a Northman stood looking down on him, the one pale-eyed in wool and fur, the five fierce in mail and plate, with a Twin Tower sigil on their surcoats.
"A fury of frays," Jamie declared. "Sir Danwell, Sir Aenys, Sir Hastine."
He knew Lord Walder's sons by sight. His aunt had married one, after all.
"You have my condolences."
"For what, sir?"
Sir Danwell Frey asked.
"Your brother's son, Sir Cleos," said Jamie. "He was with us, until outlaws filled him full of arrows. Urswick and this lot took his goods and left him for the wolves."
"My lords,"
Brian wrenched herself free and pushed forward,
"I saw your banners. Hear me for your oath."
"Who speaks?" demanded Sir Aenys Frey.
"Lannister's wet nurse."
"I am Brian of Tarth, daughter to Lord Selwyn, the Evenstar, and sworn to House Stark even as you are."
Sir Aenys spit at her feet.
"That's for your oath. We trusted the word of Robb Stark, and he repaid our faith with betrayal."
"Now this is interesting."
Jamie twisted to see how Brian might take the accusation, but the wench was as single-minded as a mule with a bit between his teeth.
"I know of no betrayal."
She chafed at the ropes around her wrists.
"Lady Catelyn commanded me to deliver Lannister to his brother at King's Landing."
"'She was trying to drown him when we found them,'
said Urswick the Faithful. She reddened.
"'In anger I forgot myself, but I would never have killed him. If he dies, the Lannisters will put my lady's daughters to the sword.'
Sir Aenys was unmoved.
"'Why should that trouble us?' "'Ransom him back to River Run,' urged Sir Danwell. "'Castle Rock has more gold,' one brother objected.
"'Kill him,' said another. "'His head for Ned Stark's.'
Shagwell the Fool somersaulted to the foot of the steps in his grey and pink motley and began to sing.
"'There once was a lion who danced with a bear. Oh, my! Oh, my!
Silence, fool!'
Varga Hote cuffed the man.
"'The Kingslayer is not for the bear. He is mine.'
"'He is no one, should he die,'
Roose Bolton spoke so softly that men quieted to hear him.
"'And pray recall, my lord, you are not master of Harrenhal till I march north.'
Fever made Jaime as fearless as he was light-headed. "'Can this be the lord of the Dreadfort? When last I heard, my father had sent you scampering off with your tail betwixt your legs. When did you stop running, my lord?' Bolton's silence was 100 times more threatening than Varga Hote's slubbering malevolence. Pale as morning mist, his eyes concealed more than they told. Jaime misliked those eyes. They reminded him of the day at King's Landing when Ned Stark had found him seated on the Iron Throne. The Lord of the Dreadfort finally pursed his lips and said,
"'You have lost a hand.'
"'No,' said Jaime. "'I have it here, hanging round my neck.' Roose Bolton reached down, snapped the cord, and flung the hand at Hote.
"'Take this away. The sight of it offends me.
"'I will send it to his lord father. I will tell him he must pay 100,000 dragons, or we shall return the King's Slayer to him, piece by piece, and when we have his gold, we shall deliver Sir Jaime to Carstark and collect a maiden too.'
A roar of laughter went up from the brave companions.
"'A fine plan,' said Roose Bolton, the same way he might say, "'a fine wine' to a dinner companion. "'Though Lord Carstark may not be giving you his daughter, King Rob has shortened him by head for treason and murder. As to Lord Tywin, he remains at King's Landing, and there he will stay until the new year, when his grandson takes for bride a daughter of Highgarden.' "'Winterfell,' said Brian, "'you mean Winterfell. King Joffrey is betrothed to Sansa Stark.' "'No longer. The Battle of the Blackwater changed all. The Rose and the Lion joined there to shatter Stannis Baratheon's host and burn his fleet to ashes.'
"'I warned you, Urswick,' Jaime thought, "'and you, goat. When you bet against the Lions, you lose more than your purse.' "'Is there word of my sister?' he asked.
"'She is well, as is your, nephew.'
Bolton paused before he said nephew, a pause that said, "'I know.'
"'Your brother also lives, though he took a wound in the battle.'
He beckoned to a dour Northman in a studded brigantine.
"'Escort Sir Jaime to Kyburn, and unbind this woman's hands.'
As the rope between Brian's wrists were slashed in two, he said,
"'Pray forgive us, my lady, in such troubled times. It is hard to know friend from foe.'
Brian rubbed inside her wrist, where the hemp had scraped her skin bloody.
"'My lord, these men tried to rape me.'
"'Did they?' Lord Bolton turned his pale eyes on Varga Hote.
"'I am displeased by that and this of Sir Jaime's hand.'
There were five Northmen and as many Freys in the yard for every brave companion. The goat might not be as clever as some, but he could count that high at least. He held his tongue.
"'They took my sword,' Brian said, "'my armour. You shall have no need of armour here, my lady,'
Lord Bolton told her.
"'In Harrenhal you are under my protection. Amabel, find suitable rooms for the Lady Brian. Walton, you will see to Sir Jaime at once.'
He did not wait for an answer, but turned and climbed the steps, his fur-trimmed cloak swirling behind. Jamie had only enough time to exchange a quick look with Brian before they were marched away separately. In the maester's chambers beneath the rookery, a grey-haired, fatherly man named Kyburn sucked in his breath when he cut away the linen from the stump of Jamie's hand. "That bad? Will I die?" Kyburn pushed at the wound with a finger and wrinkled his nose at the gush of pus.
"No, though in a few more days."
He sliced away Jamie's sleeve.
"The corruption has spread. See how tender the flesh is. I must cut it all away. The safest course would be to take the arm off."
"Then you'll die," Jamie promised. "Clean the stump and sew it up. I'll take my chances." Kyburn frowned.
"I can leave you the upper arm, make the cut at your elbow, but—"
"Take any part of my arm, and you'd best chop off the other one as well, or I'll strangle you with it afterward."
Kyburn looked in his eyes. Whatever he saw there gave him pause.
"Very well. I will cut away the rotten flesh, no more. Try to burn out the corruption with boiling wine and a poultice of nettle, mustard seed, and bread mould. Mayhaps that will suffice. It is on your head. You will want milk of the poppy."
"No." Jamie dare not let himself be put to sleep. He might be short an arm when he woke, no matter what the man said. Kyburn was taken aback.
"There will be pain. I'll scream." "A great deal of pain."
"I'll scream very loudly."
"Will you take some wine, at least?"
"Does the High Septon ever pray?"
"Of that I'm not certain. I shall bring the wine. Lie back, I must needs strap down your arm."
With a bowl and a sharp blade, Kyburn cleaned the stump, while Jamie gulped down strong wine, spilling it all over himself in the process. His left hand did not seem to know how to find his mouth, but there was something to be said for that. The smell of wine in his sodden beard helped disguise the stench of pus. Nothing helped when the time came to pare away the rotten flesh. Jamie did scream then, and pounded the table with his good fist over and over and over again. He screamed again when Kyburn poured boiling wine over what remained of his stump. Despite all his vows and all his fears, he lost consciousness for a time. When he woke, the maester was sewing at his arm with needle and catgut.
"I left a flap of skin to fold back over your wrist."
"You have done this before," muttered Jamie weakly. He could taste blood in his mouth where he'd bitten his tongue.
"No man who serves with Vargo Hote is a stranger to stumps. He makes them wherever he goes."
Kyburn do not look a monster, Jamie thought. He was spare and soft-spoken, with warm brown eyes. How does a maester come to ride with a brave companions?
"The citadel took my chain."
Kyburn put away his needle.
"I should do something about that wound above your eye as well. The flesh is badly inflamed."
Jamie closed his eyes and let the wine and Kyburn do their work. "Tell me of the battle." As keeper of Harrenhal's ravens, Kyburn would have been the first to hear the news.
"Lord Stannis was caught between your father and the fire. It said the imp set the river itself aflame."
Jamie saw green flames reaching up into the sky, higher than the tallest towers, as burning men screamed in the streets. "I have dreamed this dream before." It was almost funny, but there was no one to share the joke.
"Open your eye."
Kyburn soaked a cloth in warm water and dabbed at the crust of dried blood. The eyelid was swollen, but Jamie found he could force it open halfway. Kyburn's face loomed above.
"How did you come by this one?"
the maester asked. "A wench's gift."
"Rough wooing, my lord."
"This wench is bigger than me and uglier than you. You'd best see to her as well. She's still limping on the leg I pricked when we fought."
"I will ask after her. What is this woman to you?"
"My protector."
Jamie had to laugh, no matter how it hurt.
"I'll grind some herbs you can mix with wine to bring down your fever. Come back on the morrow, and I'll put a leech on your eye to drain the bad blood."
"A leech? Lovely."
"Lord Bolton is very fond of leeches,"
Kyburn said primly.
"Yes," said Jamie, "he would be."
Tyrion. Nothing remained beyond the king's gate but mud and ashes and bits of burned bone. Yet already there were people living in the shadow of the city walls, and others selling fish from barrows and barrels. Tyrion felt their eyes on him as he rode past, chilly eyes, angry and unsympathetic. No one dared speak to him, or try to bar his way, not with Bronn beside him in oiled black mail.
"If I were alone, though, they would pull me down and smash my face in with a cobblestone, as they did for Preston Greenfield."
"They come back quicker than the rats," he complained. "We burn them out once. You think they'd take that as a lesson?
Give me a few dozen gold cloaks, and I'll kill them all," said Bronn. "Once they're dead, they don't come back."
"No, but others come in their places. Leave them be. But if they start throwing up hovels against the wall again, pull them down at once. The war's not done yet, no matter what these fools may think."
He spied the mud gate up ahead.
"I have seen enough for now. We'll return on the morrow with the guild masters to go over their plans," he sighed.
"Well, I burned most of this. I suppose it's only just that I rebuild it." That task was to have been his uncle's. But solid, steady, tireless Sir Kevin Lannister had not been himself since the Raven had come from Riverrun with word of his son's murder. Willem's twin, Martin, had been taken captive by Robb Stark as well, and their elder brother, Lancel, was still abed, beset by an ulcerating wound that would not heal. With one son dead, and two more in mortal danger, Sir Kevin was consumed by grief and fear. Lord Tywin had always relied on his brother, but now he had no choice but to turn again to his dwarf son. The cost of rebuilding was going to be ruinous, but there was no help for that. King's Landing was the realm's principal harbour, rivaled only by Old Town. The river had to be reopened, and the sooner the better.
And where am I going to find the bloody coin?
It was almost enough to make him miss Littlefinger, who had sailed north a fortnight past.
"While he beds Lysa Arryn and rules the Vale beside her, I get to clean up the mess he left behind him."
Though at least his father was giving him significant work to do.
"He won't name me heir to Casterly Rock, but he'll make use of me wherever he can,"
Tyrion thought, as a captain of gold cloaks waved them through the mud gate. The three whores still dominated the market square inside the gate, but they stood idle now, and the boulders and barrels of pitch had all been trundled away. There were children climbing the towering wooden structures, swarming up like monkeys in rough spun, to perch on the throwing arms and hoot at each other.
"Remind me to Tessa Adam to put some gold cloaks here,"
Tyrion told Bronn as they rode between two of the trebuchets.
"Some fool boy is likely to fall off and break his back."
There was a shout from above, and a clod of manure exploded on the ground a foot in front of them. Tyrion's mare reared and almost threw him.
"On second thoughts," he said, when he had the horse in hand, "let the poxy brats sputter on the cobbles like overripe melons."
He was in a black mood, and not just because a few street urchins wanted to pelt him with dung. His marriage was a daily agony. Sansa Stark remained a maiden, and half the castle seemed to know it. When they had saddled up this morning, he heard two of the stable boys sniggering behind his back. He could almost imagine that the horses were sniggering as well. He'd risked his skin to avoid the bedding ritual, hoping to preserve the privacy of his bedchamber, but that hope had been dashed quick enough. Either Sansa had been stupid enough to confide in one of her bedmaids, every one of whom was a spy for Cersei, or Varys and his little birds were to blame. What difference did it make? They were laughing at him all the same. The only person in the Red Keep who didn't seem to find his marriage a source of amusement was his lady wife. Sansa's misery was deepening every day. Tyrion would gladly have broken through her courtesy to give her what solace he might, but it was no good. No words
would ever make him fair in her eyes, or any less a Lannister. This was the